Welcome everybody here in the CCCB to our, oh no, this is a hard one, 77th Datengarten. So in Germany you would say Schnapsal. So yeah, we managed to have quite some. And today we have a special friend of mine who will give us a talk about the bus factor and how you can calculate it using R. So first question, who knows what the bus factor is? Okay, so some not. Who just knows it because he Googled it after he read the title? Okay, we have some honest people here. Okay, that's really nice. So I think I don't have to explain it, you will do this. So, yeah, I'm really, really happy to have this talk here today and to have all of you here who didn't went to Republika and to everybody on the streams, hi, and who will ever, whenever you will watch the recordings. Also, greetings to you. I hope to see you once here at the Datengarten. And now I give the word to Robin, who will talk about R and the bus factor.
Thank you, Karina.
Please welcome him.
And thank you, data gardeners. Okay. So I'm going to go through a bit of an explanation of R, which will involve lots of monochrome code slides, which will be, well, exciting or tedious, depending on your interest. But your interest might wane a little bit, but don't worry, there's lots of colourful pictures coming later on, and we should end with some interesting insights. So try and, you know, focus or at least not snore during the science bit. Okay, so broadly then, we've got a bit of an explanation about what the bus factor is for those that haven't already Googled it beforehand. Then what I was thinking is that you might be able to follow along. So we'll just briefly introduce the tools so you can get set up if you have got your laptop open and you want to play along. And then I'll explain a little bit about how we're going to do the analysis. Run through a whole bunch of the code, showing it working, and then finally show, as I say, some charts that try and get a bit behind this bus factor. As I'll go on to explain shortly, it's just a single number, and it's much more useful to see the bits that go in behind it. Oh, I don't need to turn around; it's right in front of me. Okay, so what is the bus factor? It is, the idea is it's a bit gruesome really, but the idea is that if you have a project, a software project, and there's people contributing to it, if you lose one of those people, it can cause quite a lot of damage to the survivability of the project. And the bus factor is the idea of how many people would need to be run over by a bus before the project was in trouble. And of course, it doesn't need to be that dramatic. It could just be someone being ill or leaving and going off to go on holiday or leaving the project permanently. So if you have a low bus factor, that means that you can afford to lose only very few people. So in the worst case, no one, you know, if it's something you like your own website that you only work on your own, you can afford to lose no people before it's in trouble, because nothing would happen if you weren't working on it on your own. Up to projects that are very well sustainable without people involved and have a high bus factor, so they could afford to lose lots of people. So I'm not going to read out all the slides. This is just in here for people that want to catch up with this later. So why should you listen? And now I am going to read out what's on here because I've forgotten what's on this slide. But basically, this will be a way of showing you how sustainable your favorite open source projects are, at least one measure of that. So can the kernel survive without Linus Torvalds? It will show you, I'll just find out what else it'll show you, how you could compare that with other projects. And this analysis doesn't bear much scrutiny. It's kind of a bit more showy for talks rather than a serious tool for this. But one of the nice things about it is that you can compare different projects like for like and get a bit of context like that. And then it gives you a basis for doing more of that sort of analysis of code in a way that isn't dependent on something like static analysis, where you need to read the actual and interpret the actual code in a language-specific way. Okay, so as I say, you can watch with your hands if you want to follow along. I'll just wait briefly if anyone wants to type those in. The slides that I'm reading from are hosted on GitHub at the first link, and the second link has the source itself, which looks a bit like this here, which you'll be able to execute and follow along as you go. Okay. So you'll need two things for this, aside from Git. I'm kind of assuming that people have Git installed. We are analyzing projects in terms of the code base, so you need to access it somehow. You could, and I have done this with Mercurial and other tools, but well, you don't need me to tell you how widely available and used Git is in open source. In terms of actually using R, and this is kind of a whole talk as an excuse to introduce R and explain a bit about it, you need the interpreter itself, which I'm guessing from the looks of the backs of screens, lots of you are using Linux. It can be a bit tricky to search for in package managers, so because it's just one letter long, it also can be a bit tricky to search for. And search engines as well, but you can get the binaries from the CRAN project, or search for RBase in Ubuntu, for example. And I also recommend that you use the RStudio IDE. It's really well integrated, so you have the R interpreter, and in fact, I'll show you that on the next slide. I don't have to wave my arms around. I've got a mouse. So this is the interpreter down here. It runs as a REPL, read, evaluate, print loop. So you'll recognize this from languages like Ruby, Python, Clojure, that sort of thing. Up here, you've got a source code editor, syntax highlighting, all that sort of thing. And the reason that I like it so much is that you can fire lines from this top frame down to the bottom and inspect the results as you go. So you kind of, build up your code interactively. I should probably explain what a REPL is if those that haven't used one before. You put a line of code into it, it reads it, figures out, evaluates the result, and spits that back out to you. So you can see here, what I've done is created, is that visible? Can you read that at the back? Created a variable that's just an array of numbers. So x is 1, there's a colon in there, to 10. Y, and that is over here. This is basically your local environment showing you what's in memory. Y is a random number with a normalized distribution, and 10 of those. So we just get 10 random numbers varying with a mean of 0 and a standard deviation of 1. And we can add those, or rather combine those things into a data frame. And a data frame is a native object in R that's like a spreadsheet. So you've got a two-dimensional table. The columns have names here, X and Y, and we've got those in there. So it's nice that you can send these things directly from your code to the REPL, see if it works, change your code until it all works, and develop things iteratively. And the other nice integration is this in sort of the help pane. And it also shows plots in here, so you can build up plots interactively as well and see how they work before you record them to file or whatever you're doing. Okay, so how do we figure out what the bus factor is? The naive approach that I've taken is to basically say a person's knowledge is proportional to the number of lines of code that they have authored, or as is necessarily the assumption here, that they have changed most recently in version control. So we are heading towards a table that looks roughly like this, with the names of the authors and the numbers of lines of code that they've committed. And eventually I'll work this up a little bit further, because we want to be able to compare very large projects with very small projects. So we'll look at relative numbers of lines of code. And we're also not particularly bothered about who the rock stars are in the code base, just how many people there are to get up to a certain level of knowledge as the code as it is. So it's a bit naive. We can definitely challenge these assumptions here, but I'm hoping that you'll agree with me that it's a sort of a simple tool that needs to be interpreted simply. It does sort of give you a point to leap off into more complicated analysis. Okay, so how do we get to this table here? First thing you need to do is clone a repo. I'm going to start with GNUPG in these examples, just because it's nice and small and it runs quite quickly. If you do this on the kernel, it can take hours, so I didn't want that while I was messing around, and I didn't want any of you to try and do that while you were watching. The first thing we do is just take an example file here. So here I've just taken this make file and get what Git calls the blame. And if you've not seen this before, it's sort of characteristic of the of Torvald's style. But the blame is basically who is the author of each line of code in the file. And what I've done is jumped for a bit of core utils help here. Git blame line porcelain does is gives you like 10 or 20 lines flat for each commit log message with the author and the date and the commit message and all the rest of it. So I'm just grepping for the line about the author and then cutting the value of the author's name off. So this is the first, eight lines of the make file, and just showing us the name of the author in each case. So what we actually want to do is add these up and count how many lines were authored by each of these. It's only two here so far, authors. But first we want to run that from within R. So this looks like a bit of a mess, but basically all this bit here is the line that you've just seen here. But I'm wanting to do string interpolation to put the name of the file in here. And string interpolation is horrible in R, but it's basically a function called paste. And we've got all these things separated by commas, and then the name of the repo path and the file name being interpolated in there. So I'll just explain a bit more about what you're seeing here. This arrow function is an assignment operator in R. You can use equals nowadays, but it's more idiomatic to use the arrow, and it has important distinctions about when you're inserting things into different memory closures. We don't need to worry about that at all, but just to sort of explain the background to some of these eccentricities. The other interesting thing here is that we are then, so this CMD at this point is just a string that looks like that by the time you've given it a repo and a file name. An intern basically means that it records the result of this system call back. So when we run it on the GNUPG repo for that file, we get back a vector, which is another base type in R, of author names. So you can see what I'll have in most of these examples is when I'm creating a function or something, I'll just indent it this far. And this is to show you that it's being called then at the console. R has lots of automatic pre-printing things in place. So here, because you're so often dealing with large arrays and that sort of thing that you need to paginate, is just helping you keep track of which is the index number of the first item in the line. So we want to count those authors. We want to know, you know, how many David Shaw, how many lines attributed to David Shaw, how many lines to Werner Koch. And I'll show you quickly the table function in R, and what that does is create a frequency table. So again, I'm assigning into the shoes variable a vector, character vector, which is basically just an array in most of the languages, of shoe sizes. And when you run table on it, it counts up the number of instances of a given unique value in the array. We could do that for our make file. And then we see it's mostly one individual with a few lines from others scattered around. And this is picture that will develop more or less consistently as we move on to other files. What I want, rather than just this table format, which is a kind of an odd labeled array format in R, I much prefer a data frame. And those are the spreadsheet type data types. And you will find when you start using R that when you move away from it to work in other languages, this is one of those data types that you really want to have available to you. And so the as data frame simply does a conversion, but because It knows what the name of this sort of row of things, of labels here, is of authors, but you need to give it a name for the unlabeled part here, the numbers. Otherwise, it would call it freak for frequency. So I've just given it a response name there. Is this all right for pacing? Is this yeah? Okay. Yeah, please shout out if it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, that's so the. Sorry, yeah. So the question was, why does Werner Koch have 129? And the answer is that that's the number. So the source is. Each of these is the name of the author for a line of code. So the name Werner Koch has appeared 129 times. So there are, let's add this up, 130, 143 lines of code in that file. And he did. He was the author of 129 of them. that's everything we've just seen, but wrapped up in a function. Nothing new here except quite a common pattern in a lot of languages. The last thing that's in a function body is its return value. But what we need to do now is repeat this over all of the files in the repository. So we need to firstly get a list of all of those files, and then we need to use some sort of mapping apply function. And that's where you start to see stuff coming in now that's a bit more specific to R. So again, jump to git and core utils to get that list of files. And then paste that into an R function, same pattern here again. And we give it the directory name, and it returns back an array of all the files. And it will also have the relative path to the repository's root. So this next step is there was a lot of functions in R historically for doing this, and they kind of like developed over time and all have hideously different argument structures. There was a clever guy who noticed a common pattern in amongst them, Hadley Wickham, and he's responsible for, in fact, he's probably like the bus factor zero for the R community because he's written most of the main libraries. He talks about the split, apply, combine strategy. So here we're wanting to take this data frame and figure out the average value for each average value of y for each possible value of x. So the strategy is basically split it into pieces according to what the common thing is, so x. Then calculate the average and then combine them back up. And if you want more details, I've got another talk that's linked here that goes through that. So this is probably the first equal of two most complicated slide in the set. So if you don't get it, just glaze over, and we'll catch up with you in a second. It's not too important to your understanding of the rest of the talk. The ADPLY function, the DDPLY function, are both from the Plyer library, and they're labeled with the letter being what thing that you want to go from and the thing you want to go to. So in this case, array to data frame, and in the second case, data frame to data frame. So we give it this vector of all of the files in the repository. And this is another one of those weird things that just crops up and doesn't really help your understanding in this kind of talk. But basically, you can look at arrays column-wise or row-wise, which isn't really important when it's just a single dimensional array. In fact, it doesn't make any difference when it's a single-dimensional array, but it's useful if you're looking at multidimensional things. So it needs to know here whether it's row-wise or column-wise. We then give it a function. So this is effectively now mapping this function over this vector. And then we pass in an additional argument to that function. And finally, because, as I say, this takes a long time in large code bases, you get a little progress bar, which is quite pleasing. And then what I want to do is this will basically give me a large data frame that says one column will be the file, the next will be the author, and the last will be the number of lines. But what we actually want is to sum that across all of the files in the repository so that we just have a table with author and total line count across all files in the repository. And so the second function will basically take the results of the first, and then it will, in the same way as we're breaking down by X here, it will break it down by author. So it will return a result for each author using the summarize method, which basically aggregates many rows into a single one. And it then takes the argument line count, which gives a label to the result of the sum of line counts. So don't worry if that doesn't make too much sense. It's not too important. And I encourage you to play with this at the REPL. And there's basically too many things to explore and understand about this to fit into one slide, so I'm just going to skip over it. But when you run it, you get this nice little progress bar as it's going. And as I say, for large repos like the kernel, I think it took me about 4 hours to do the kernel. But then you get something like this. So each author, total number of lines across all files in the repo. And as I say, the initial picture hasn't really changed much. But these aren't yet in order. And we also can't really make much sense of this. What we want to know is what happens when we start removing people to how important are they, relatively speaking. So we need to look at their contribution. So this is the other complicated slide in the talk. And I'm going to flip between this and the results. And perhaps if I start with the results, it might be easier to understand what's going on here. So this is where we're heading. So we start from here, and we end up here. So what we want to do is sort the authors in terms of the number of lines they contributed. We want to then think about that in terms of their cumulative contribution, because the idea here is we're not saying what is the impact of removing any random person from the repository, from contributing. What we're saying is, and again, it gets a bit gruesome if you go back to the bus metaphor, but we're basically lining people up in front of the bus in order of their commitment in descending order. So it's the worst case scenario of who gets run over or, you know, who catches a cold and is off. So we're looking at the cumulative line count, and what we're looking to do, kind of arbitrarily, is to say after we've got rid of the most knowledgeable person first, which actually means the most prolific person first, and we keep going, how far do we have to get before half of the knowledge, half of the lines of committed text is gone? So we're looking for this cumulative number of lines of code, and we're later going to want to understand projects in terms of So this is basically how many people has the bus run over. This is how many lines of code have been lost. And this is then that expressed as a percentage. So we can start to compare large and small projects. And similarly, the number of authors expressed as a percentage. So we can compare projects with more or fewer authors. And so, and the way we do that then is, firstly, we sort, and this is something that is completely mind-bending when you first start using R, but basically those data frames, like this, their sort of standard method of access is this, it's kind of like a lens, basically, but you give it the square brackets, and because they're two-dimensional, you know that the first argument is to specify rows, and the second argument to columns. And you can see the second argument here is blank, so we want all columns back. So the first argument specifying the rows, you give it a set of indices that will choose which rows in which order. And the way you do that is by ordering the column with the line count in decreasing order. The dollar here is an accessor for a column with inside a data frame. So that gives us basically then these author lines, but sorted in order of their line count from the biggest down. We then take the cumulative sum. So the cumulative sum function basically just takes each thing it receives and keeps a running total. So that's how we get to this column here. Then we want to start numbering the authors And this is where we'll pick up our bus factor from, basically. So projects that have very even, very small contribution from the most prolific authors, we'll have smaller numbers here, and we can kind of get a bit further with the bus before we go over our halfway point. I really ought to find a nicer metaphor for this. So then the final two are basically just calculating percentages, and we do that by taking the whole column and then dividing each by the maximum amount in that column. And this reveals, it looks kind of smooth, but it reveals something that's really sneaky in R, which is that when you take a shorter vector and apply it together in a function with a larger vector, without saying anything, it will repeat, or it calls it recycling, the shorter one, even to the extent where it isn't a factor, it doesn't go in an even number of times, you'll just use it halfway, which really catches you out if you're not looking, because there's no warning for it at all. What it means is that things like this, where you've got a vector and you're dividing it by an integer, a scalar, then it will reuse that scalar for every item in the vector. So as I say, there's quite a lot of code, if you've not seen our code before, just to basically explain what this is. But now we can kind of move on to the actual analysis itself. So what I've done here is created a function that takes the inputs of the shape that we saw in the last example, authorship contributions, and an arbitrary threshold defaulting to half. And then what it does is it says, take this table and only give me the number of rows until we get to the cumulative line percent of 50%, which is basically saying how many authors, starting with the most prolific to the least, do we need to have, to take away, to run over, before we've got halfway through the total number of lines of code. So that here then looks at this cumulative line percentage column, checks whether it's below the critical threshold, and takes back only those lines for which this condition here evaluates true. And then it counts the number of rows. So if we do that with GNU PG, it's zero. We basically can't afford to lose Wernicke. Okay, so that's quite a long-winded way of showing you how it all gets calculated. Now we can start to look at some pretty pictures. I'm going to use this as an excuse to introduce the grammar of graphics, which is an idea by the invisibly small named Leyland Wilkinson there. Again, quick plug for another talk, go through this in more detail, but basically it's a taxonomy for describing visualizations that allows you to build them up from a set of base elements that once you've learned, you can build some quite fantastic things. So import those two libraries. And then we create one of these grammar of graphic plots. We pass it this authorship contribution, which has those cumulative author count, cumulative line percent columns. The AES function is basically an aesthetic mapping, which means I want to take something out of my data frame, my source data, and then map it onto something that describes quantities in a visualization setting. So here, I'm using the advantage of something R does where it you can either give it named arguments when you call them as parameters in a function, or if they're in the right order and they're unnamed, R assumes what they are from convention. So in this case, X and Y, the most commonly used aesthetics in a visualization, certainly in a two-dimensional one on a screen, which is like the vast majority of them. So we now have our plotting area available. GGplot gives us the scales, and it knows what the size of these are. So it already has an idea that the percentage contribution an author makes in GNU PG, yeah, that was right that time, is between 75% and 100%. And there's up to about, 47 or so authors. So we want to actually draw something on the plot. So I'm now adding to the previous value the point geome, so this geometry, so this is just a mark. So each one of these dots is an author, and they're drawn in terms of their cumulative contribution to the code base. So these steps each get smaller each time because they're drawn in order of how many lines they most recently edited, or rather committed. And then we've got the author count, so this is the order that they're in, so you can see it curving up like that. Rather than points, I want to present a line because it can get quite busy with some of the bigger ones. Then I don't really like the way that the rest of the chart looks. So, what I'm going to do is put in my critical threshold for the bus factor. So basically, if the first few authors are below this line, then the project's safe. And I'll show you loads of other projects in a minute, and we'll repeat the interpretation. But just to show you that now makes it quite hard to see because it's now getting scrunched up. So I will put it in context. So this is basically now the bottom of the chart shows us no one having contributed anything, and the top is all the code that was in the code base. And you can see this where this line starts shows us where the first most prolific contributor kicks in. Then we have simply labeled the axis using scale y continuous, which is just a continuous linear scale. First parameter defaults to its the name of the legend here. And then the labels argument basically takes the values and figures out some way of presenting a tick marks for them. So in this case, we want percentages, as you can see. Then the next thing I'm doing here is an interesting trick in a lot of cases. And because I've picked a small example, it's not quite as apparent why it's important. But basically, a logarithmic scale is being introduced here on the x-axis. And I'm going to flip between them in the hope that it kind of becomes apparent what's happening. Rather than in this linear case, each unit distance, so what we're talking about there, 40 centimeters, 30 centimeters, is 10 authors. Whereas in this case, it's 10 times as many authors. And I've put the same tick points in so you can see that it gets sort of bunched up towards the end. And this is important because we're really more interested in this section at the beginning of the curve. And it will be more useful later on to compare a range of different projects. But you'll just have to sort of bear with me for now that this is worth doing. Then you always need to put a title on the plot. So there it goes. And I'm a big fan of a guy whose name I can't pronounce, can't be that big a fan of him. I think he pronounced it Tufte, an American author specializing in quantitative visualization, and he talks about the data ink ratio, which is basically the amount of ink on a visualization that's devoted to explaining or encoding data. And you see quite a lot of these visualizations with, you know, like smiley faces and unnecessary what he calls chart junk to sort of like tell a story or whatever. But I'm kind of much more of this minimal approach where we're just looking at data here. There's no unnecessary ink spent on decoration. However, it is possible, if you want to try a different theme, to spend some unnecessary ink on decoration. So this is the XKCD theme, which took an inordinate amount of time to set up that little man on the corner because you need to parameterize every joint. But it's fun. The nice way the ggplot set up is you can do this sort of theming, change to have a corporate color scheme, you know, use your own fonts, all the rest of it. Okay, so let's get into some of the analysis itself. These are a few projects that I selected to look at, and I'm kind of presenting these first set in a pretty random order, but I think this is a nice one to start with here is the kernel, and you can see now with this long T shape why it's important to have the logarithmic scale, because otherwise each one would just have that kind of like harsh elbow shape with, you know, very few very big contributors and very many very small contributors. That power distribution is quite common across natural phenomenon, and you quite often end up using a logarithmic translation to be able to look at small things and big things at the same time. Yeah, so the kernel is basically the winner for all of these. I'll give the end game away now. 139 contributors before you lose half of it. So the answer to the question that I posed at the beginning is basically yes, we could afford to lose Torvalds. Of course, that's, you know, quite a strong claim to make off the basis of one small analysis. And what I'm actually saying is the author who wrote the most line of code in the kernel could afford to go without us losing 50% of them. Obviously, in real life, more people understand lines of code that Torvalds has written and not, and of course he reviews other things that are attributed to other authors and plays an important role, so I don't literally believe that we should run him over with a bus just to prove that we can. But I think what's exciting about this is it shows you the strength and the robustness of the Linux kernel code base. Some other large, big open source projects here, similarly showing that there's a good, healthy team of people. You could imagine they're being able to lose or at least rotate staff and afford to carry on going. I did our studio for fun, and you can see as well that wouldn't survive very well with the loss of a single author. And quite an interesting one here that we'll come back to later. And that, this is kind of when I started this this analysis a couple of years ago, and it was around the time of Heartbleed, and that was kind of one of the more interesting areas to look at. And I've got a few more slides. This is from 2 years ago, so I've got a few more. Hang on, what are we on now? 2017, 3 years ago. So I will show you an update later. So the editor wars, Vim versus Emacs. Sadly, you can't have another report from the battle lines of this age-old conflict because of the way that the source code is arranged in Vim. It's basically commit number one is Bram Mulanar. I don't know how that might be his name, I think. But the main Vim guy, and commit number two is like code robot 105 or something. I don't know exactly, but this is some sort of amalgam of other commits that have come from some other mechanism. But the way that this project's arranged just means it's not amenable for this sort of analysis because you've only got 2-3 authors in there. But Emacs at least is not showing you any major worries about losing Stallman, and I believe that Stallman's commitment is much smaller than that, actually. But you know, big names. So another one that, and I really probably ought to update this with Maria and the rest now, but shows a dramatic comparison with Postgres there and MySQL Server, and much more of as a percentage of the code concentrated in fewer hands. And you can see, as well, I was pointing out, the key things to interpret are where this line starts in terms of height, and it always starts at number one because it always has to be the first contributor, but also the length to which it extends on the x-axis, so how far it goes that way. And you can see Postgres doesn't extend quite as far as MySQL Server, and it looks to be about twice the length, or rather width, which you can't interpret as twice as many, but this is like, you know, tens, hundreds, as many people there, at least in terms of the code that I accessed for this, or rather the authors listed in that code. So here's a handful of projects that will help those people of those influences, as we were discussing earlier, from the web community. So Apache HTTPD is pretty healthy. Projects like Rails are also But some of these sort of newer, so D3 is a JavaScript visualization framework, mostly owing to Mike Bostock and his work on this, but it pretty much exclusively relies on him. Nearly 3/4 of the code base touched by his hand last time it was checked. So what else do we have here? Yep, personal cloud software. They're in alphabetical order here, but really this chronologically, I suppose it'd go the other way around. You can see the next cloud curve extends slightly further out, and whatever's done since that fork has introduced more contributors making a larger contribution. So the bus factor increased from being able to lose 2 people to being able to lose 5. I also went through earlier on today a couple of projects that I thought might be interesting to people here. These are smaller projects, so you can see the. Whereas when we're looking at some of these, we're looking at up to like thousands of authors, of different authors, and these are, you know, a handful of people involved in them. So it's less surprising, therefore, to see these smaller bus factor numbers here. So back to OpenSSL, and this is the sort of concluding part here. I'm assuming that this is not gone without the notice of most people in the room, but there was this Heartbleed vulnerability that entered the OpenSSL source tree at the end of 2011 and hid there for some years. And it was finally disclosed and patched in April of 2014. And after that, the Linux Foundation launched the Core Infrastructure Initiative. And the idea was basically people were a bit shocked that such an important and sort of important in terms of its the number of businesses and applications that relied on it, but also in terms of how critical it was for security. Such an important project could suffer from lack of review, basically. So they made some money available, relies on sponsorship now, and it gives funding to different projects to try and shore up core parts of the infrastructure. So this is an animation showing you what we saw in the previous few slides, but over time with the last, I think it's 19 years of OpenSSL source code. So I'll let it run and then I'll just explain again what's happening. So basically, you can see the data up there. And what we're watching in terms of our bus factor analysis is how many of these dots are below the line. And you can see that 2012 there goes in the fatal commit, introducing the heartbeats with the vulnerability in it. And then, so basically what happens, I suppose, in 2014 is everyone switches on and suddenly a lot more people start contributing and paying attention to OpenSSL. So we can see the length of this line shoots out, far more people committing. But in terms of our bus factor analysis, it it isn't just going down. It actually starts to tip back up again. So I guess this is basically either because the core contributors started to get a bit worried and start committing more code, or maybe because of core infrastructure initiative paying those people to do more. I've not actually checked that it's exactly the same people committing, so it might be completely new people coming in, but basically a higher percentage of the code base in recent years is actually down to fewer people. So it's not from this analysis, as I'll show you the summary of that trend here, it goes up but then comes back down again after 2014 or so. But the number of authors after Heartbleed, the number of authors shoots up quite sharply. And what that means is because the most of them making small contributions is the number of average lines per author falls. So also now just with this, the final slide, and this warrants a bit of explanation because most people don't have to deal with box plots on a daily basis. But basically what we're looking at now is a summary for each year of the number of lines committed by each author. And what the box plot does is it starts out with two whiskers, and the ends of the whisker, I'll do it this way around, the ends of the whisker are the maximum and minimum of anybody, any of the authors, maximum and minimum number of lines that they committed. Then you go further toward the middle and you see the what's called the interquartile range. So that's the 25% and the 75% bars. So the middle 50% of people have committed a number of lines of code inside that box. And then the black thick line, horizontal line, is the median. So on average, half of people have committed more than that many lines and half below. Again, we've got a logarithmic scale, so take care to see that. And the black dots are basically outliers that are more than 2.5 times this distance away from the middle, so anomalies. So you can see that basically most people are committing, I guess, in the 10,000 to 2,000 range, something like this, for most of the history of the project, with a few people doing the odd commit here. And after 2014, we suddenly get an influx of many, many authors who are all basically committing a few lines, less than 10 lines, half of them. Now, whether or not that means that OpenSSL has better oversight and is more secure, I don't know. It certainly means that the bus factor didn't really improve in a resounding way, like we can see with the kernel or some of the Apache projects and that sort of thing that we looked at before. But it's certainly the case that there's more eyes on it. And yeah, so hopefully that is certainly better than fewer eyes. So hopefully that's good. Okay, so that's the end of the slides. I guess I'll open up the floor for questions.
So if you have a question, please let me know so you can get a microphone so everybody on the stream and the recording can understand your question and know what the answer is about. So any questions? Okay, so I'll start with one. I mean, to be honest, I already knew a little bit about... What? I know a little bit about the bus factor, but is it right that it's just like the worst case scenarios that you lose like 50% of the code? It's not, I mean, it depends on, I mean, if it's for the kernel, it's Linux, of course, you lose more than if it's just a random developer. So this is a worst case approach.
Yeah, exactly. So it probably would be more realistic in terms of actual, the real world scenario isn't that people cross the road in order of their contribution to open source. So a more realistic scenario would perhaps be to randomly remove people and see what the effect is. And you can do something called... you can basically bootstrap this with simulation, which is to say you test each code base 100 times, removing a random person, and see what percentage of the lines of code falls. So there's a few areas we could sort of take this to extend it, and it certainly is, you know, if you look too closely, it does sort of fall apart. Yeah, so not particularly realistic.
Am I right that you did only an analysis of a single revision for each of the projects? Except for OpenSSL. If something happened in an extreme case, if someone reformatted the whole code base and changed nearly every line, then he would appear as the main author for nearly everything.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And another question. Do you think it would be feasible to do an analysis of the whole of GitHub, or at least all larger projects? I don't know. You said that it took some hours to do the analysis for the Linux kernel. I'm not sure what it is, how long it would take. And then you could do a larger view of a typical bus factors and how much they vary.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you've basically highlighted the reason in your first question, that because it's kind of susceptible to peculiarities. So, you know, it might be that most of the work happens not in the master branch, or that someone changes tabs to spaces, like you say. And so you kind of need to get around that with cross-validation, statistically, which is basically to get more agreeing things that build a bigger, richer picture rather than just looking at this one number from one simple analysis. I would be interested to know what scope there was for speeding up the process. I started using the Git library in R, and that was really slow. So that's why I ended up using Core Utils, because it was a bit faster. But my suspicion is there's a way you can basically pull stuff out of that .git folder or the reflog or whatever other magic blob stuff happens inside Git, because I don't need to pull out every piece of information about the commits. It's just what the author was of each line. But the amount of time it takes to figure out how to do that was longer than the amount of time it would take just to set it running and go off and do something else. So I took the lazy option. To do it in bulk across a lot of projects, I think would be really interesting, particularly combined with something like randomly pulling out individuals, not just the prolific ones.
Have you tried a post-mortem analysis of some projects and to see if you're right or wrong? So just, for instance, take the moment the numbers of commits decrease exponentially and compare this to the number of active committers?
Take the moment. So just run that one by me again. Take the moment the number of...
You just take a dead or undead project and... Just looking at the numbers of commits per time, the commit rate.
Right, okay, yeah.
And maybe there's a moment where the commits decreased.
Yeah, so you could, I mean, certainly you'd expect that commits per unit time falling off would be sort of a predictor of a project either being perfect and reaching a state of perfection, or everybody giving up on it. And it would be interesting to see if there were a kind of like trigger people who were particularly popular in the project or something, and once they left.
Yeah.
So is there a kind of a multiplier effect from any given individual, and is that proportionate to their relative contribution? So you could imagine that if somebody who was at the front of that bus stop queue,
yeah,
left, and then suddenly you like three other people went, that would be an interesting, a way of cross-validating that metric to see if it has any other knock-on implications.
One idea is, if I lose code which is well documented, it's less bad for the project than if I lose good documented code. It's less bad for the project than if I lose bad documented code. I have to say, I always hope I never meet anybody who has to maintain my own code, but many people also hope that I never find out that they have written the code I have to maintain.
Yeah, certainly. That's so this is kind of one of these key areas where if you just start poking a bit, it all falls down. So you would say, for example, if you were looking at the proportion of lines committed by a Java developer versus, what was the one I was looking at, APL, something like that, where, you know, one of them's full of boilerplate and you just sort of type a few lines and generate 10K of lines of code from some sort of framework versus something where, you know, like a regex where every single character counts. You can't compare them like that, which is why you kind of need to just sort of take a step back and ignore the levels of documentation, ignore how well tested something is, ignore the fact that languages are different and different lines have different significance to the sustainability of a code base, and just rely on the fact that we're making relative comparisons. So you're comparing Java files with Java, and getting to a number that's relative for the amount of lines in any given code base, and just hope that it balances out on average. But yeah, it doesn't say anything about code quality.
So in general, as I see it, there's a lot of possible optimizations to get a better number, to get robust, more robust against documentation and stuff. But I think the problem then is that you get that you make your calculations much, much more complicated. Because, I mean, counting lines is like really one of the simplest things ever. But if you want to try to get everything in, and I know when we worked, I mean, line count is used as a metric in a lot of places. So often for like productivity of a developer or something, and everybody figured out that it's a crappy thing to do because it's not really, yeah, as you said, it's created or something. So it's not really helpful there. But to be honest, the numbers, they seem to be quite a good indicator here. So the bus factor, because it's, I mean, to be honest, for some it was a little bit of a surprise, but for most projects, it's what you heard about them, because everybody heard that SSL just had not enough developers, and everybody knows that there are a lot of active developers on the Linux kernel and stuff. So I'm surprised how you can get from such a simple metric, which is not working well for a lot of things, to such a number, which is quite a good indicator. Yeah, just wanted to mention that. It's the magic of statistics.
Yeah, I was quite relieved when I saw that OpenSSL, because I knew we were saying about predicting. I knew the answer with OpenSSL because we'd seen Heartbleed, so I was quite relieved when it came up with a low bus factor, which isn't really the way that you should do statistical analysis. But I think and this is kind of like a lesson for all statistical work, that understanding the context is absolutely vital. And if, you know, I could imagine people taking issue with any one of those projects and saying, well, that doesn't really fairly reflect it. And I would, you know, immediately put my hands up and say, you're probably right, I didn't look at the code base. But the more sort of criticisms you seek to deal with, in the same way with any code base, the more bugs you fix, the more sort of clunky and complicated it becomes and the harder it is to reason about. So it's kind of a trade-off.
Okay, do we have any more questions? Okay, for everybody who couldn't take place, will you provide the slides for us so that people can... they are on there. Yep. Okay, perfect. So everybody who wasn't fast enough, like I lost track directly in the beginning, but so I intended to listen instead of try to code next to you. So I will try this with my projects.
Yeah, there's a link there. I'll just show you what you're getting in case it's of interest, if I can remember how to turn full screen off. There's the slides themselves and some code in there, and the code is a lot easier to rather than like copy and pasting things out of slides, if you just load up that file and you can just hit Control Enter in our studio and it'll just run each line and you can just see what's happening as you go through.
Okay, perfect. So thank you very much for this talk and for all your answers to our questions. And everybody who perhaps has another questions, I guess we'll see you around a bit on the bar and have a drink together or something. So if somebody's coming up with another question, you have the chance to do this later. So there was our Clarisse Datengarten for today. You're all happy to hang out with us here, and I hope to see you again next month to whatever topic we will come up until then. Okay, bye, thanks.
Thank you.